welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street. We're halfway through the week, and we are glad that you are with us today here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We have a packed show for you. In the second half of today's show, we'll have another edition of Prairie Plates. Rick Gian and I catch up with Sam Williams from Bismarck. He has a food truck named Mabel's All Day, and the background on why he is in North Dakota is a lot of fun. Plus, another edition of our news podcast, Prairie Beat.
Why the alarm? It may not have been the PSC's intent, but this pill has become the vehicle seen by opponents of public notice in newspapers to put state government in charge of the people's right to know.
And Main Street begins today with that clip from Cecile Warman, executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, testifying before the legislature last spring in opposition to Senate Bill 2069, which would have allowed public notices to be published on the Secretary of State's website to satisfy the legal requirements that newspapers announce all public meetings. In the end, a compromise was reached, and the bill Governor Armstrong signed allowed for notices to be published on the North Dakota Newspaper Association's website, or the proper governmental website, should a deadline be missed by the paper. That was only one of the challenges newsrooms, especially rural publications, face in North Dakota. Warman sat down with Prairie Public's director of radio, Ann Alquist, for this conversation.
I'm going to start off with a column that you wrote and published, I think, in a number of North Dakota newspapers. You talked about a post-reading world. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's actually something that I came across in an article, and it was just like, who's reading my mail? Because it was exactly what I was thinking, but it put it into words and gave some examples of how, with AI, you know, why read? Like, is it really possible that we could get to a point where we don't even read because we have somebody to read it for us? We have Siri and Alexa and, you know, all these AI bots to read things for us. Could it really be true? And basically, what this article purported was that now with TikTok and our smartphones, podcasts and oral presentations like that are replacing reading. And so it's like going back to the caveman days when we sat around a fire and told stories. You know, like that's what we're talking about. We're moving to a point where people would rather listen than ever read. And so while that might be good for public radio, it's not so good for newspapers or any more in-depth type of information that people need in their daily lives to understand, you know, how their rights could be taken away or what their local government is doing.
Well, I think the other piece about it as well is that what the AI chatbots are scraping are digital print stories. And of course, those are written down.
I have a great example of that.
They need the text. Share the example.
Well, I was talking with a gentleman who's actually trying to get newspapers compensation for that. Perfect example is in Crosby, North Dakota, where the only news source is the Journal. There was a story about an apartment fire. One night, the next day, as I'm talking about this with someone, I search on Google for Crosby apartment fire, and AI tells me the first five sentences of the news story, which is the part that's published publicly, not behind a paywall, and they already had it. And there's nothing that references the Journal. There's nothing that says, hey, a local reporter gathered this information for your consumption.
It wasn't sourced.
No. I mean, off to the side, there's the Journal website, but there's actually even two different modes now on Google. I just got a new computer. It automatically defaults to AI. If you go to, there's something like, I don't know, it's not classic, but it's some other way you can have it sort. If I sort in the traditional way, Crosby apartment fire, the first hit is the Journal of Crosby. But if I source in AI, that newspaper is completely cut out of it. And that's really frustrating because, and I'm using the Journal as an example, of course, because I am still a publisher. I do own the Journal in addition to being the executive director of the Newspaper Association. But it really brings home for me how all of our members are impacted too, because they're paying people to go out and collect that information. And then Google and AI is delivering portions of it, probably the top line information, for free. And we get no compensation for that.
So you're on a tour at the moment. You talked to a Rotary Club for your Read Local campaign. And as I understand it, I mean, you are advocating for people to pick up their local newspaper.
Right. And it isn't even pick up their local newspaper. I mean, let's face it, newspapers are online. We have websites, we have apps, we're on social media, we send out electronic newsletters. The problem, as I see it, is that we are now, local attention is now in competition with the whole world. Nobody says the World Wide Web anymore, but literally, that's what we're in competition with. When people are carrying a smartphone, they have so many other different sources of information coming at them that the local matter that is also available there, whether it's in print or online, is lost. And so just like Shop Local a few years ago tried to remind people how important it is to patronize mom and pop stores so that, you know, they're not eaten up by Amazon and Walmart, Read Local is the same concept exactly.
Well, let's talk about one of the issues that you spoke about at the legislature, which was public notices, and those are very local. And the legal papers of record, they publish the public notices.
The head of the Public Service Commission, Randy Chrisman,
he wanted an appropriation to have the Secretary of State's office publish them and have that qualify for the public notice to be considered. The legality of it is that it's got to be published in the local paper. Where the local government is having the public meeting or where the Public Service Commission is having the meeting that would affect that particular community. One of the things I really wanted to ask you about is why those public notices are so important. And you talked about local attention. I mean, those public notices are not going to be, you know, the meetings in Tioga, it doesn't matter if it's published in the New York Times. But locally, it has an impact on that local community. Talk about the history of public notices in newspapers that has been around since the founding of our nation, if not before.
I believe it dates back to around 1792 when the U.S. Postal Service was actually invented in part to make the penny press available to the, you know, wide masses of people so that there would be information about not only local government, but what the federal government was doing back.
I think it was one of the first things that President Washington signed, actually.
Yeah.
That's how important it was.
And so, you know, it was so important to our framers that individual people across the countryside have access to information about what governments were doing, that they literally gave newspapers a favorable rate, and that extended for many, many years. It's no longer the case. In fact, we're really under the gun with the Postal Service. But the system of public notices, whether it's at the city, county, state level, basically says that you have to notify people if you're going to do certain things so that they have a chance to respond. That's a participatory government. And so if we lose public notice, we have a group of either staff people at a state level or city level making decisions that impact voters, and they would have no say in it. If there were no hearings or no warnings, basically, that, hey, there's something coming down the pike. And so that's what gives people the opportunity to know that. And what's difficult is that, you know, there's a real push because of costs to say, let's just put this all on a government website. Our research shows that 83% of people do not want it on a government website and don't trust that that's going to be good enough. But not only that, just practically speaking, how much time do you as an individual have to spend monitoring your city website or your county government website or your state website? I mean, that's what we as local news organizations do, is we curate that information and bring to your attention those things that you really need to pay attention to. Nobody has time. You know, I've said many times that social media turned everybody into a publisher. Now, if we lose newspapers, it's going to turn everyone into a news gatherer, too. And you already have a job. Whatever your job is not to be a reporter searching out all these facts that newspapers pay people to bring to you in a curated form, you know, select to your town. Government websites aren't the answer. And if you say, well, newspapers are a failing model, Well, the problem is we don't have anything to replace them that everybody's going to have easy access and inexpensive access to.
And they're also hyper-local in a way that broadcasts cannot necessarily be hyper-local. I mean, Crosby, Tioga, I'm thinking of Mohall as well. When you get down to the nitty-gritty, there's not an economy of scale for like a statewide broadcaster, yeah, such as a Prairie Public. I do want to talk about Mohall because the longtime editor and publisher, LaVon Erickson, passed away quite young, actually, of cancer, I believe. And, you know, one of the things I did want to ask you about was finding a new editor and publisher for the Renville County Farmer. Can you take the story from there? Because I know that you were involved in that.
Yeah. And what a success story. And we're actually recreating it now in Ashley Wishick. And it's based on the belief that there's nobody better to take over from a longtime publisher like LaVon, who was just, you know,
I mean, tireless.
So tied into her community. I mean, she was like the statistician for every home sporting event for decades, just as a for instance. We know that the best people to take over a local newspaper is someone who's already connected to the community, rather than having some chain outfit swoop in and try to hire someone to do that job, which, you know, sometimes that works. But if we can get a new group of owners in. And so what we did was I said, let's have a town meeting. You know, let's bring people in and make them aware of what's at risk when you lose your local newspaper. And this is something really personal for me because I had to close a newspaper in the last 2 years myself in Tioga due to a lack of staff. Nobody wanted to work there. I mean, couldn't find anybody. But through that town meeting, a series of four different local people came forward and looked very seriously at purchasing that paper. And ultimately, it was purchased by someone who already lived in town. So it's continuing. And now a native of the Ashley Wishick area, who already has a full-time job, is taking on those two papers because of that publisher, Tony Bender, passing away back in December. And so those are two really great success stories that show if communities make it known, we want to be served by a newspaper, somebody will step forward to do that.
The other piece I think that is interesting about that is that it wasn't a case of the economics. You know, 'cause we hear about that a lot in the national media about papers closing because the ad revenue is getting eaten up by Craigslist or digital advertising or what have you. But in these cases, I mean, this really came down to succession planning and just someone who has the desire. The business model is still there for newspapers.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt it's changed and, you know, it's under pressure because of the postal increases and even the tariffs on aluminum plates that print the printed editions.
From Canada.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're under attack from a lot of different areas, but in those local communities, nothing can replace it. That's why these things, 73 newspapers in North Dakota still, more than one in a county in a third of the counties. That's why they're so vital, is because they serve a very particular niche, and we have to educate communities to understand that if that newspaper ceases publication, even for as little as a week, more than a week, it could be lost. And it's tied in with the legal definition of a newspaper. You have to publish continuously in order to receive legal public notices. You have to meet certain qualifications with the Postal Service, so postal permits can be at risk. So we are trying to be very proactive that we don't get a call one day that says, hey, okay, well, we just closed down our newspaper because of XYZ, either the owner's sick or we don't have anybody to work or whatever the case may be. No, let us know in advance so that we can help try to find someone local to step in and keep that rolling because it's so vital. They don't have a radio station in these little towns. So what's there to replace it if they close? Facebook and TikTok. Well, how much time do you want to spend on Facebook and TikTok collecting all the information that your local newspaper gives to you every week?
For this Read Local campaign, I'm looking at your pen here. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the campaign and its origin story. How did you come up with it? I mean, obviously, in the business that you're in, you're an ambassador, an advocate. You testified at the legislature. Tell us about how you came up with this Read Local concept and What do you get? You're obviously here. You're talking to Rotary clubs. What's the duration of the campaign? Give us the details.
Well, I think this is something we'll be focusing on for some time, at least a period of a year. And actually, you know, I mean, I'm just starting this. It's just out of the gate. But it dovetails with a change in focus at the North Dakota Newspaper Association. Traditionally, what we have been is an advertising agency. You know, we place statewide advertising for companies and organizations that want to reach all of our members. And so that was the bread and butter that supported our organization. And it doesn't pay the bills anymore, honestly. What's more important for us to do at this time is to sell newspapers, not advertising. And I wish I could come up with a different name other than newspapers, because it doesn't say what we are. We are local news. And I use that term a lot, just talking about local news, because in 95% of North Dakota, local news is a newspaper in your small town.
Well, I mean, I'll also just say, as a statewide broadcaster with a newsroom, I mean, we rely heavily on those local newspapers because they are writing the first draft of history. And then we're able to do our job, which is to amplify an issue, create a statewide conversation, advance a story, you know, or add a different perspective to it. But the news really breaks, as we like to say, at that local level. And that first draft is almost entirely written by a newspaper with the reporter with the boots on the ground at the meeting.
And so you wonder, because basically AI is doing the same thing, although in a very predatory fashion. They're culling, scraping our websites to get words and facts to put on a search engine. But what happens when we're not there anymore? It's like the newspaper industry has done such a poor job telling this story. All of us in the industry can take some blame for it, that we just don't, instead of hand-wringing and telling people, oh my gosh, we're like a guy laid up in a hospital bed and we're on life support. We should be telling people the story about how thriving communities are tied to thriving newspapers, and how newspapers become an engine that keeps your town thriving. That's the message that we need to get out there before it's too late.
So where can people get more information about this initiative, read local, and maybe pick up a pen?
Well, our office is located in Bismarck on the corner of 5th and Main. And so we welcome the public to stop in and learn more about us anytime they'd like. Our website is ndna.com.
Well, Cecile Warman, Executive Director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, have fun talking about Read Local, and I'll see you on the road.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Prairie Public Director of Radio Ann Alquist speaking with Cecile Warman, Executive Director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. According to that association, there are 73 weekly newspapers and 10 multi-day newspapers in North Dakota.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances, all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
Did the National Weather Service cuts worsen the disaster in Texas? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The flooding in Texas during the July 4th storm killed at least 129 people, including 36 children. And as of July 13th, there were still about 160 missing.
The Guadalupe River rose around 26 feet in 45 minutes after rain fell at a rate of up to 4 inches an hour in some places, and along a basin that's nicknamed Flash Flood Alley because of its terrain.
Questions have been raised regarding cuts made by the Trump administration to the National Weather Service, which may have prevented forecasters from warning of possible flooding.
Alan Girard, a recent retiree of NOAA's National Severe Storms Laboratory, wrote on Substack that the National Weather Service did a solid job and there's little evidence that any of the recent cuts negatively impacted the agency's services for the event.
However, the Trump administration has proposed cuts that would close that laboratory, which develops tools to predict flash flooding.
The disaster has also raised questions about why Kerr County, where the flooding occurred, didn't have adequate warning systems, including sirens. The New York Times reports that last October, FEMA warned about potentially dangerous flooding in the area with a loss of life and damage to property.
However, local officials were rebuffed by the state in their attempts to secure the $1 million it would take to build the system.
Earth's glaciers and ice caps are melting rapidly because of climate change, which will cause sea levels to rise, influence weather patterns, and affect freshwater access around the globe. Another consequence of losing all that ice, according to a new study, more explosive volcanic eruptions.
Researchers led by the University of Wisconsin-Madison say that hundreds of dormant volcanoes worldwide, particularly in Antarctica, could become active as global warming accelerates melting.
Thick layers of ice can keep a lid on eruptions by pressing Earth's crust that sits atop chambers of magma. Once a glacier retreats, the gases in the magma can expand and the volcanoes explode.
The link between glacial loss and volcanic activity has been known since the 1970s, when eruptions in Iceland were linked to retreating ice. But the team says it could happen elsewhere, like parts of North America, New Zealand, Antarctica, and Russia, so they warrant closer attention.
Lead author Pablo Moreno-Yeager says that eruptions can cool the planet temporarily, but multiple ones can accelerate global warming by pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. That creates a feedback loop where melting glaciers trigger eruptions, which in turn can further warming and melting.
For more accurate forecasts, utilities rely on historical data to predict future performance, and recently this has meant using artificial intelligence.
However, AI can only be as good as the data it's fed, which can be scarce in rural areas. So researchers at Charles Darwin University in Australia investigated whether adding indigenous knowledge to the mix would enhance accuracy, given First Nations peoples have been observing natural cycles for thousands of years.
The team integrated information from the seasonal calendars of four First Nations communities in northern Australia and found that the forecasts improved by nearly 15% and had an over 25% reduction in errors compared to a baseline model.
Unlike our modern calendars with four seasons, ancient ones developed by First Nations can range between 3 to 7 seasons based on ecological cues such as plant and animal behaviors, which are closely tied to changes in sunlight and weather patterns.
The team's new data set is the first to incorporate First Nations knowledge and could be a valuable tool for advancing solar in rural areas, especially in the places where indigenous people live.
That's it for this week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Still to come on Main Street, from California to Mabel's All Day in Bismarck, Sam Williams is serving it up local. That's ahead. Stay with us.
I like bagels.
Some barbecue,
applesauce, and some nice red beets.
There's that theme music that greets us every Wednesday here on Main Street. Rick Gion joins me in the Main Street studio. And Rick, I have a question for you. What do you get when you combine local produce, a love for community, a food truck discovered and named after this person's grandma, and a person who was stuck inside his house in California due to COVID? What do you get?
You get a guy named
Sam Williams.
A guy named Sam Williams, yeah, who's with us today.
Hi, Sam. Welcome. Hey. Welcome to Prairie Place.
Yeah, thanks for welcoming me. It's nice to be here with you.
Sam is a chef, a food truck owner, and a board member at Biz Market. Bismarck's beloved community farmers market, and from hyperlocal organizing, Sam is helping build some flavorful and meaningful food in the heart of North Dakota, and we get a chance to talk with him on Prairie Plates. And Rick, if it's okay, I'd like to start with this food truck story. I think it's fascinating. How did you get started in the food truck business, Sam, when you were in California?
Yeah, it was kind of a call from my mother-in-law, my wife's mom, and she said that here in Bismarck, there was a food truck that was for sale, and we should move here and open it up and start a business.
And we all listen to our family when they tell us to move from California to North Dakota, right?
Exactly. Yeah. In any other year, I think it would have probably just been water over our backs. But it was 2020, and we were kind of stuck inside trying to figure out what to do and living in a beautiful place without the ability to go out and enjoy all the things that we wanted to. And we looked into it, and, you know, the North Dakota Small Business Administration was super amazing. They helped us get funding, and our business plan was accepted right away. And so we were just sitting there saying, oh, okay, we're doing this then. And then that was when we hit the road.
What's the most popular item that people ask you for from your food truck in Bismarck?
Oh man, for a long time it was a toss-up between our smash burger and our mad fried chicken sandwich. And I mean, these are two amazing selections. Our smash burger, we use locally raised beef, homemade buns, homemade pickles, homemade sauce. The mad fried chicken is a buttermilk brine chicken thigh that we crisp up, and both of them are served with hand cut fries. And it's just two really great selections, and they were the popular ones, and I'd say it was a toss-up. And now we have a new third contender, which is our street tacos. We have three different tacos that we use on a rotational basis. We usually serve two of the three on any given day, and they are just so amazing to produce and cook for people. We do a locally raised lamb birria taco. We do a pork belly taco that has shredded cabbage, avocado salsa, and these pickled rajas. It's a mix of carrot, onion, and jalapeno that we put on top. And then we also do a carne asada taco with a pineapple salsa. Also, that's locally raised beef here from North Dakota.
What's the name of your food truck?
Our food truck's name is Mabel's All Day.
I like that, Rick.
I've actually had a few of those things on the menu. The fried chicken sando, I call sandwiches sandos. Smash burger, fresh cut fries, and some of the tacos. And I think there was a bacon and brie sandwich on the menu I tried at the Fargo Food Truck Festival a while back.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's a fan favorite. It's one of those dishes that I've been doing that one for a long time, and if you've never had brie cheese, you know, or arugula, which a lot of people that's new to them, I mean, once you bite into this sandwich, if you're adventurous and you want to try it, you know, and it's not wild, it's just different. It changes people's minds about food, which is really cool. And that's some of the things that we really enjoy about what we do.
Well, that was one of my favorite items at the Fargo Food Truck Festival. That must have been four years ago, something like that. Some other friends of mine like the fried items, but I like different flavors and different ingredients. And your truck was definitely unique there. And you also use a lot of local ingredients for your menu.
We do, yes. We try to support as many local growers and producers here as we can. Now, North Dakota has a small growing window and a small harvest window, but the summertime is really when we shine. We use growers called Forager Farms out here in Bismarck, and they do our multigrain bread, and we get greens from them for our salads. We use a guy that grows corn, organic corn. Later on in the season, we'll do that for our elote, our street corn dish that we do, and he does fantastic organic corn. His name is Shane Doctor, just a fantastic product that he puts out. And then we use so much of this local beef from Legendary Steaks, and they're out of Napoleon, and it's just like, you know, when you eat a cut of beef that just kind of transports you, you know, you're just like, Oh, this is amazing. And we use a skirt steak, which is one of their lesser known cuts, and this, I'm telling you, Rick, this cut is just amazing. So
skirt steaks are tasty.
Tacos, yep. They are.
Sam, I have a quick question for you. How do you handle the seasons in Bismarck, where you come from in California, you know, year round, you're good. If you wanted to do something like this, it's a little tougher here though. How do you manage?
Yeah, so when we started our food truck, we wanted to operate it as year round as we could. And so during the winter months, we would do pickup orders for Thanksgiving and Christmas, and that would kind of get us through. But, you know, some years you could have 16 inches of snow on the ground from October to April. And then other years it could be a very mild winter. So we really just kind of rolled with the punches and operated in that way. One year we tried to do an outpost in one of our local saloons here in Bismarck, and that worked out really well, but it kind of ran its course after a year, and we decided that just doing the food truck was great for us.
And what's the background story with the name of the food truck?
Yeah, Mabel is our daughter's name is Mabel, and she was named after my wife's great-grandmother, Mabel Small, who has roots here in the Bismarck area, just dating back to, gosh, I think her family homesteaded here. I don't want to say what year because I'll probably get it wrong, but they've been here for a long time. So yeah, that's where the name Mabel came from.
Rick, let's turn the page and talk about Bismarck, if we could, with Sam. Is Bismarck a traditional farmer's market, Sam, or is there something that kind of sets it apart?
You know, I think the community has grown around Bismarck so much in the 4.5-5 years that we've been going there. Just seeing the new vendors that show up and the new produce stands that are coming up, we have seen it go from maybe 50 vendors or 45-50 vendors on a weekend to now 75-80.
Wow.
And just, you know, you can walk down the aisle and you can see things from Forager Farms are grower, natural nourished by nature. It's a regenerative farming. You know, they're a fantastic company. There is a brick oven bakery. There is a different coffee shops. There's a coffee shop called Chug's Coffee, which is really fantastic. There is Oat and Toast, who's been doing things. And Kate, like these different versions of businesses that are there, it's just really amazing. So I think that's what's the big draw right now, is that the different options that you have when you come there.
Where is the market and what are the hours, Sam?
So every Saturday we're at Kiwanis Park in Bismarck, right across from the Lark Stadium. And the hours are from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m.
And that's Sweet Avenue just off of South Washington, correct?
That's right, correct.
Rick and I have talked about the food truck, I guess, environment here in Fargo. How would you say it is in Bismarck?
It's growing. I think it's a new concept for a lot of people. Definitely when we're in the winter time or in the colder months, people are used to dining indoors. But, you know, with online ordering and people being able to come pick things up or delivery services, it really does expand the options for people. And for us, we have a great parking location that we're at consistently, where we have picnic tables out and you can come sit down and enjoy. And it's really a fun experience.
There are a lot of food trucks out there right now. Grand Forks, Fargo, Bismarck, Minot, a lot of good stuff. There's always room for more. And one of my questions for Sam was, you've been to Fargo, obviously you are headquartered in Bismarck. Are there any unique rural communities that you take your truck to?
Yeah, so we've been to Hazen, we've been to Beulah, we actually been down to Mobridge, South Dakota as well. There's just a lot. Linton has been, we did a 4th of July in Linton one year, which was fantastic. A lot of these communities really, really want to see some new options, the smaller ones. And if you go to the fairs or the rodeos or these street fairs that they have, you know, they're excited for new food, you know, and they support it. And I've talked to other food trucks around Bismarck here, and I can't tell you how many times they said, you know, we went up to Hazleton or Moffitt and you know, we went to this little street fair and we just had the greatest turnout. And so, you know, the people here in Bismarck and also in North Dakota, they love a new option and they love supporting these things. And it's just a great community for it.
I agree. And You know, cheese curds and funnel cakes and oofta tacos are all delicious. We all, no one loved them, but trying an arugula apple bacon brie sandwich on that fresh bread, boy, having that new experience or just having a quality item on the menu, I think really elevates things and elevates the food scene in North Dakota.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And a great example is our lamb tacos, braised, locally raised lamb with pickled turnips and a three pepper hot sauce is just like, people say, oh my gosh, what is that? And I've never thought of trying lamb. And we raised, there's a lot of lamb raised in North Dakota. And they try it and they're converts right away. They're like, yep, that's it for me. I'm getting the lamb tacos next time. So, you know, that's probably the most fun that I have when I'm cooking for people is just that experience of them trying something new, enjoying it, and maybe even telling someone else or coming back for it again and saying, you know, I just really am so happy to come try this again. It was so great last time, or I really enjoyed it, and now I want to try one of your other offerings. Or, you know, it's just such a fun thing.
And that lamb birria, is that a braised leg of lamb?
So we do shoulder and leg. It's essentially the whole animal. So I get whole lambs and they quarter them for me.
Wow.
And I'll braise them. We go through a lot of it. So I'll braise it probably half of an animal, and then we'll run it and we'll sell out of it. It's amazing.
I'm hungry, Craig.
Me too. Our guest on Prairie Plates today, and we're grateful that Sam Williams has been with us. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Sam is a chef and a food truck owner and a board member at Biz Market, Bismarck's beloved community farmers market. And you can also find him at Mabel's All Day, his food truck that has a great name and a wonderful legacy. Thanks for joining us on Prairie Plates.
Hear the past come to life on Dakota Datebook 5 times a day, Monday through Friday, on Prairie Public. We tell North Dakota's story one colorful character at a time. Dakota Datebook, your daily dose of North Dakota history on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Summertime weather is still very much on the mind of North Dakotans. While many of us are dreading more potential severe weather, in other parts of the state, there are hopes and prayers for rain. Let's listen to this week's episode of our news podcast, Prairie Beat.
Hey there, I'm Eric Deffer.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thank you for joining us once again for another episode of Prairie Beat.
It's our weekly news podcast where we look a bit closer at some of the headlines from our Prairie Public newsroom. Danielle, what's on the beat this week?
Well, a few weeks back, Eric, we actually discussed drought conditions in North Dakota. And this week, I've been looking around at all these rain showers, and I just kind of wondered to myself, how are things in North Dakota? Is it still dry? So I picked up the phone.
I'm Daryl Richardson. I'm the state climatologist for North Dakota and also the director of the North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network.
Well, I think if you want to talk about the weather, a former TV weatherman and current climatologist would be pretty good. Daryl Richardson, great place to start there.
Indeed. So before we get into it, I think we should back up first. The last time we talked about this, let's be real, it was pretty crispy in North Dakota. Much of western North Dakota was not just dry. There were levels of moderate, severe, and even extreme stages of drought. It was also abnormally dry in eastern portions of the state, including the northern and southern portions of the Red River Valley. And we had just experienced a flurry of fire activity. The dry conditions coupled with very strong winds unfortunately ended in dozens of fires breaking out. It was reported that North Dakota's Department of Emergency Services responded to 60 separate fires. And perhaps most unfortunate of all, 40,000 acres had burned in the state. That's about twice as much as is considered normal.
Yeah, I do remember that quite well. The red flag warnings, they covered much of the state. Burn bans were issued, and we were even warned to keep an eye on anything that might spark a fire because if we did start it, it had the potential to get out of hand, and they really did. But it certainly has been raining lately, especially this week. Did Daryl Richardson say things are any better regarding the drought?
Well, yes and no.
I guess all in all, I would say maybe half the state is dry and half the state's doing pretty well. so far this summer.
Okay, well, half the state, that's no small portion.
I caught Daryl as he was getting all his data together for the weekly U.S. Drought Monitor updates. Everybody gets all their data and they analyze it, and then they send their recommendations to the U.S. Drought Monitor, and then they make up the maps. And when you look at the latest update, as of this record, to say that half the state is dry is pretty accurate. So let's just say you have a peanut butter jelly sandwich, right? And you're going to cut it in half for your kid for lunch. I might be speaking with a little experience here, but, you know, that's whatever. But I like to cut the sandwiches on a diagonal. So if North Dakota was that sandwich and you made a diagonal cut from left to right, or the southwest corner up to the northeast corner, give or take three or four counties in the northern valley, that's pretty much the line that denotes drought. Everything west of that diagonal line is at least abnormally dry. There are pockets in the northeastern corner and then the south central area along the Montana border that are considered to be moderate drought.
Okay, so aside from craving a peanut butter and jelly sandwich all of a sudden, obviously that's not the greatest prognosis there at all, Danielle. But you did say a moment ago there were portions of the state that were far worse earlier this summer. So it does sound like there has been at least a little bit of improvement.
For sure. One of the things Richeson said was he gets a lot of comments from people about all the rain, you know, quote unquote, and how it had to have helped. But he also says he's getting comments from places that tend to be a little more heavily populated in the state. It was abnormally dry in our region earlier this summer, so that tracks. As fate would have it, rain has fallen a bit more on those population centers this summer. And maybe it's been falling often, but it hasn't really been falling at levels that are needed to stomp out the problem areas. A longer range forecast from earlier this year did sort of see this coming. Richeson says with the driest portion of the year coming up, things can change quickly.
You know, the warmest part of this year so far has been in May of all months. But, you know, June and July really hasn't had a lot of heat. I think August will probably not make up totally for it, but I think August will finish a little bit above average, say a degree or two above average, with many parts of the state below average with precipitation. So I just think the state might look a little bit differently on Labor Day weekend than it does now. And I hope I'm wrong in the parts of the state that have been so dry lately, because if we continue those areas dry, there will be a noticeable change then once we get into this fall.
Well, that does sound pretty ominous there, but it really does sound like those longer range forecasts we talked about on that earlier episode really are coming to pass for the most part.
One thing he said that I found interesting was that we actually average way more precipitation in August than we do in all of winter. But because of the heat, we lose the effects of the precipitation due to evaporation. And that certainly could lend itself to, once again, even drier conditions in the state. If it stops raining for a week or two or three, the landscape can change course. He also says, you know, he makes recommendations to the U.S. Drought Monitor based on what he sees. So we just have to see what the author of the monitor decides to publish.
So now that I'm thinking about that earlier episode we did on the drought and the fires, Danielle, I seem to recall you mentioning a fire map that people can use. Thankfully, nothing is on fire right now, but if the people smarter than us are looking at the data and saying it might get dry, it might be nice for our listeners to recall that useful tool.
Absolutely. So you're thinking of the ND Wildlands Fire Monitor from the North Dakota Department of Emergency Services.
Yep.
And it's literally what you just described. It's a map of locations of actively burning wildfires in the state. You can pull it up right now to see that, again, thankfully nothing is burning, but that certainly can be a useful tool when conditions call for it. And while we're at it, looking at the U.S. Drought Monitor can be helpful too, just to see what regions of the state are headed into those drier conditions. I always just Google U.S. Drought Monitor and it pops right up. You can click on what region you want to zoom in on, and then from there you can click on specific states too.
Excellent. Thanks for all that great info, Danielle, and for those helpful tools for the toolbox. In the meantime, why don't we now take a look to see what else is going on in the Prairie Public Newsroom. What are this week's three leads?
Number one, Jason Stuglmeier is Bismarck's new police chief. Dave Thompson has been following this story as outgoing chief Dave Drayovich retires. They had some finalists, but Bismarck police have made their choice for their new chief. Number two, changes coming to North Dakota's medical marijuana program. The state legislature made some tweaks to the law, which will allow patients to access medical marijuana via edibles. Program manager Jason Wall says they're being allowed a conservative approach. And number three, Armstrong requests presidential disaster declaration after June 20th and 21st storms. We reported on those storms right after they took place, more than 20 tornadoes, a derecho that caused widespread damage and four unfortunate deaths as well. North Dakota has asked for federal assistance to help recover.
Yeah, that was quite a weekend of storms a month ago now already. I still think about that every time there's humidity in the air and things feel a little weird. Yesterday, like, the crows were acting funny, so I thought, like, what?
No, not the animals.
Coming? Oh, yeah, gosh. Hopefully we can finish out the summer without more events in regards to Mother Nature. Hey, thanks for being with us this week for Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
You can find more on these stories by visiting the Prairie Public Newsroom at prairiepublic.org, and be sure to subscribe to Prairie Beat wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 23rd. True simplicity in fishing consists of a bamboo cane pole, about 10 feet long, attached to a fishing line of about the same length, with a bobber, sinker, hook, and a wriggling worm. Sitting on a dock, riverbank, or the shore of a lake, pond, or stream, all you have to do is wait for your bobber to go down, and fun begins. In the deep past, a bamboo cane pole was every kid's starter rod, an introduction to the lifetime sport of fishing. Little line tangling, lots of panfish nibbling, much bobber watching, and all the delights of angling. On this date in 1903, an article in the Cooperstown Courier compared the qualities of a cane pole made of bamboo imported from Japan to those of an old-fashioned wooden pole made of hickory, ash, hazel, or willow. Quote, "Every country schoolboy is aware of the superiority of a bamboo fishing pole over any other. Its flexibility, lightness, and strength distinguish it sharply from any American pole and make it better suited for a fishing rod than one made from any wood grown in this country." The U.S. imported several million bamboo fishing rods every year, with perhaps 10 million from China and Japan sold by 1910. Generations of North Dakota kids dug in their gardens for enough angleworms and dirt to fill a tin can before heading to their favorite fishing hole, with bamboo pole in hand, out to catch bluegills, sunfish, pumpkin seeds, black crappies, or maybe even a bigmouth bass, a rip-roaring northern pike, or a keeper walleye. The anticipation of fishing was almost as sweet as watching the bobber go down. Those bobbers changed through the years, from bottle corks and balsa wood to red and white plastic balls, and most recently, foam slip bobbers that make it easy to adjust the depth of the bait. And that bait could be night crawlers or angleworms or grubs or grasshoppers or frogs or minnows or leeches, maybe even a kernel of corn. Whatever the bait, when the bobber went down, the joy came up. Isaac Walton said it best. "We may say of angling, as Dr. Boteler said of strawberries, doubtless God could have made a better berry, but doubtless God never did. And so, if I might be the judge, God never did make a more calm, quiet, innocent recreation than angling. Doubtless, too, a bamboo starter pole could get a kid hooked on fishing." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
The Bismarck Cancer Center Foundation invites you to the 13th Annual Bluegrass Goes Pink, Saturday, July 26th at the Cross Ranch State Park near Washburn. You can help support cancer awareness by starting early at 8 a.m. for a fun 5 or 10K walk or run on the beautiful Cross Ranch trails. Then enjoy supper served by the Washburn churches at 5:30, followed by a concert by the Cottonwood Bluegrass Band. All proceeds go to support the Bismarck Cancer Center Foundation.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us today. Tomorrow on the show, we'll revisit the topic of youth sports here in North Dakota with Dr. Brad Strand, Professor Emeritus from North Dakota State University. Are we getting youth sports right, or are we getting it all wrong, and is it too late? Dr. Strand has a lot to say, and we'll visit with him tomorrow with you right here on Main Street.